Blog Talk Radio.
Your show.
All right, welcome everybody. This is the Ron Brooks Show, and today we have a special episode. We're going to be covering three main topics, I think, today. We might actually end up splitting the videos into three. I guess I should say happy Passover to all you Jews out there. Being one, obviously, I went to a really nice Puerto Rican restaurant tonight. San Juan has some of the best food anyway. Anyway, we're going to do three topics today. We're going to talk about South Africa, and we've got a guest with us to talk about that. Then I'm going to make some comments on Ben Shapiro's comments, on my comments, on his comment about Ayn Rand, something like that. So it's like we're having this whole debate going on with me commenting on his videos and him commenting on mine. Then finally, I want to comment also on Robert Reich's video. So, wow, we've got some people from Israel. I think it's even later in Israel than it is South Africa. So, all right, so we're going to start with South Africa. And let me just give you some personal context here, and then we'll bring in my guest, Christo. So I have roots in South Africa. Both my parents were born there. My father was born in Johannesburg. My mother was born in Durban. And they grew up in South Africa. I still have a lot of family over there. My parents, when they got married, left South Africa and emigrated to Israel, and I was born in Israel about a year after. And I've been to South Africa a number of times, but I have to say I haven't been back to South Africa since apartheid went away, and which just saddens me because I'd like to go back. It's one of the most beautiful countries I've ever visited. It's truly spectacular. I've driven all over, in a couple of my trips, rented cars, just drove all over the place and got to see South Africa. It's quite a beautiful, beautiful place. As I said, still have family there and would love to visit sometime. Hopefully sometime in the next few years, I'll have an opportunity to go give a talk or do something in South Africa. But there's been a lot. South Africa's been in the news quite a bit. A number of different topics, three really jump out of the headlines. One is this land confiscation. We're going to talk about that, the idea of confiscating the land of white farmers in South Africa. The second is the idea that there is white genocide out there is an idea that is spread by the alt-right and others on the right that are convinced that whites are dropping like flies all over the South Africa. So we'll dig a little bit into the numbers and see if that is true. And then the water crisis in Cape Town. Supposedly Cape Town is going to run out of water any day now, I guess, sometime in the next few months. There's literally going to be no water. The taps are going to go dry. A real drought in a major city. I don't think it's ever happened before. To talk about these issues with regard to South Africa, I've got Christo, and I'm not going to try to pronounce your family name.
That's okay. Thank you for having me on your own. Thank you very much.
Okay. My pleasure. And Christo is a researcher at the Free Market Foundation of South Africa, so a free market think tank. He has been a student at the Objectivist Academic Center and an Objectivist. He's on Facebook and Twitter and so on. And he writes quite a bit for the Free Market Foundation on issues related to South Africa. So let's start, Christo. Maybe talk a little bit about this land confiscation. I mean, there was a lot of press here in the U.S., and I think it somewhat misrepresented the issue, because the way it was presented here is that Parliament had voted to approve the confiscation of land of white farmers by the government with no compensation. So eminent domain, but no compensation. So let's first let's go through the process, because that's not accurate. What has actually happened and what is yet to happen?
So in our constitution, in section 25, we have our property rights clause. And that's the focus of this whole expropriation without compensation thing. That's what they're calling it. At the beginning of March, the ANC, the African National Congress, that's the majority party in our parliament, they and the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, they introduced a motion to amend Section 25 of our Constitution to allow for land expropriation without compensation. I think constitutionally speaking, it's already in our Constitution that you can seize land, that the state can seize land if they provide enough compensation to the owner. But now the EFF have gained popularity in the country. They're more left-wing than the ANC. And with our elections coming up next year, I think the ANC are trying to get as many votes in as possible. Land is a sensitive topic in African societies, especially with colonialism and land invasions and all that sort of thing. So the ANC is moving more left now. And in order to get some votes, they're telling people, well, you know, vote for us and allow us to amend the Constitution and we'll give you X, Y, Z. There's a constitutional review committee that's been appointed. They'll come back at the end of August and sort of brief parliament as to whether the constitution needs to be amended or not. Just this last week, I attended a land summit in Johannesburg. It was attended by media and political parties and analysts. And two members of parliament from the ANC themselves said that it's not a given that the constitution will be amended. They're investigating the whole thing. They're trying to see, you know, what the process will be, but we shouldn't all panic. I think the ANC is realizing from foreign investors that maybe this is not such a good idea, you know, that they need to be more careful. So they're backtracking in some areas. So we'll see. It's a bit up in the air, but at least they're softening a bit in their rhetoric. So we'll see.
And we'll know that by the end of August?
Yeah.
Okay. And so let's go through this. So first, I mean, every constitution pretty much out there allows for the government, unfortunately, to seize land with compensation. I mean, the American Constitution allows that through eminent domain, and it sounds like the South African Constitution allows it for the public good. The government can seize land as long as it compensates its owner. So I think from an objectivist perspective, we reject that idea wholeheartedly. Government should have no right to seize land under any conditions, even if they pay you quadruple the market price. It's not an issue of price. It's an issue of principle. Your land is your land and should not be seized. To what extent have as the government in the past tried to kind of buy farmland owned by whites in order to transition it to hand it over to blacks?
I think in some areas of the country since 1994, since our first democratic elections, the government has done it and it has been successful. When they've handed over title deeds, so they've given the right of the property to the, you know, the black farm owner, so he can actually use it and put the land to use. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't help having land if it's not actually under your name. Then you can never be productive in it, and you can never do anything with it. But I think part of why it's becoming such a hot topic now is because the process has been slow, you know, there's a lot of pressure on government to deliver services such as water, electricity. And now people assume if you have a piece of land, you'll be affluent and wealthy, and you know you'll increase your personal wealth, and you'll be able to trade and all that sort of thing. So it's sort of a get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
They assume if they give land, then you know black people will be in, you know, necessarily better off without giving them the skills or the monetary aid or anything like that. So in some areas it's been good, but it's slow as government tends to be, which is why I think it's becoming such a hot button issue.
So it strikes me that it would be good in places where the farmers have cultivated land, the land is owned by nobody or owned by the state, and they get a deed on it. So I think that's an issue of justice. And I think that's what's going on a little bit in Soweto right now with the mayor of Johannesburg. He's giving deeds to people who already have squatted on the land, but it's government land. They're not stealing it from anybody. But what is being proposed now is literally taking the land from white farmers because they have too much, and giving that land to blacks. So what is the justification given for that? Is it the whole issue of colonialism?
It's partly that. I think it's also partly the inequality issue where, you know, you assume that because someone has land, therefore he is wealthy. It doesn't really matter what he does with it. I guess that's sort of a, you know, I guess that's Marx's influence coming in. So, you know, just, you know, the landowner, the workers of the land don't actually get anything. It's the white owner of the farm who takes all the profits and that sort of thing. But with the economic freedom fighters now, with them introducing this motion to amend the Constitution, I mean, they're the most left-wing party we have. They've said that the state will be the custodian of all land. So this includes Ours is flat.
Oh, I see.
You know, urban property. It's not just agricultural land.
So there's
land,
no private land. They demolished basically private property completely.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're trying to bring to sort of public attention, because it's not just a case of white-owned farms. It's going to be no black people, no white people can own land, which, you know, black people, their land was taken by the British and Afrikaners. And so we're trying to sort of get them to see the gains we've made under democracy and the constitution and property rights, and not roll back on all of that stuff.
So a couple of things. To what extent is the motivation of the EFF versus racist? Is it a racist motivation?
Mm.
Or to what extent is it a Marxist motivation, or is it a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. Their leader, Julius Malema, he was part of the ANC, but he was kicked out. So he sort of decided to go full left wing to sort of, you know, throw up, you know, sort of a sign to them that either they follow him or, you know, they're going to lose their base, their support. He's repeatedly said that, you know, that the white farmer must be killed. Europeans must go back to Europe. You know, he said things for which one could be convicted of sort of hate speech. And we do have a hate speech bill coming soon. So he might need to be a bit more careful with what he says. I don't think he realizes what he's doing. But I think for him, it's a case of just garnering support and trying to grow his party. And, you know, as with a lot of left-wing politicians, it's about political expediency and practicality and, you know, just getting support, and the consequences be damned.
But is there a sense among Africans is there a racist streak among blacks in South Africa that he is feeding off of? Because I think
that the media will tend to overhype that racist, that there's this racial tension between South Africans.
Okay.
The Institute of Race Relations, they do annual surveys on relations between different race groups. And for example, in their latest one, I think the issue of land was not either or any of the top three of the most pressing issues for black South Africans. So I think that they do realize that, it's, you know, because a white person has X, it doesn't mean that that's why they don't have X. I think that they tend to be suspicious of the government, especially because the government isn't delivering, which is now why the ANC and EFF are trying to be more radical.
Sure.
I think that racial tensions are overhyped, and that he's trying to tap into something and make more of it than there is.
So it would you say that it's more the Marxist element, the kind of the leftist element, than it is the racial element?
Yeah. It's you know, it's easy for the government to blame, to have a target to blame instead of their own inefficiencies inability to deliver anything. So.
Well, and they've been a statist government forever. You know, since they came into power, the ANC has been. What is your expectation of what will actually happen with the land expropriation?
As an optimist, I guess maybe it's false hope, but I am cautiously optimistic that come the end of August, that the review committee will come back and tell us it's already in the constitution. We don't have to radically amend things. Maybe they'll put in a temporary measure that'll have to pass constitutional muster. And again, it's up to our constitutional court, which does sometimes tend to go on the more radical interpretation of the constitution. We tend to think of our constitution as guaranteeing state must provide, you know, basic services.
Yep,
they must provide education,
like
healthcare, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful. It's been a transparent process so far. I think they realize that they could scare investors away. And just now that Jacob Zuma was kicked out and Cyril Ramaphosa came in, we've seen an increase in foreign investment, the stock market's doing better, the Rand has strengthened. So I think the ANC realized they need to be very careful with what little progress that they're making now. There's also been talk that they wanna move the elections closer to the beginning of 2019 to, you know, sort of make hay while the sun is shining, so that they can get more votes. So we'll see.
Is this president a significant improvement over Zuma? I mean, where does he come down? I mean, he's a former businessman, at least, so he knows something about business.
Yes. He has worked in business. I think whereas Jacob Zuma was more, you see, it's difficult because I think Zuma he spoke the communist rhetoric, but he was in it for himself. So he was corrupt and he was a crony, but yeah. he looked after himself. He didn't use the state apparatus to, you know, to actually impose communism.
Okay.
Whereas Ramaphosa might be a bit more of an ideologue, and you know, that's a scary thing. Like an effective communist is a scary communist.
Yes.
You know, you'd rather have a corrupt communist than, than an effective communist.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are hopeful on him because he speaks better. He's more educated than Zuma, but that could be, you know, a false, sort of a false impression.
Sure.
So as always, we need to be vigilant and we need to hold him accountable.
Okay.
He is more pro-business, so we'll see.
A Marxist who's pro-business, that's scary.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're cautiously optimistic. Now let's quickly review, you know, kind of the history of the last land confiscation in that part of the world, which is it was in Zimbabwe. And I think you know, I had relatives in Zimbabwe when it was Rhodesia, and they owned a lot of land up there. And what happened when that land was confiscated?
So Zimbabwe used to be known as the breadbasket of Africa.
Yeah.
They exported a lot. Now they have to import pretty much everything. When they kicked white farmers off their farms, you know, through force, that resulted in the complete collapse of their economy. Their inflation is through the roof. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's sort of a Venezuela type situation.
Yep.
So it's...
You would think South Africa would learn the lesson from their neighbor.
So, yes.
I mean, it's close. And, I mean,
yeah,
the economy completely collapsed. They were literally starving. They had to import food. They were getting food aid from the U.S. and Europe. This is the breadbasket of Africa, because, you know, once they confiscated the large farms, and would think people would learn.
I'm sure you're aware that they've got a new president now as well.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens in South Africa. Maybe we're all gonna head north. Whereas Zimbabweans used to come south, so when their country collapsed, maybe we're all South Africans are going to get
there. Well, you know, if I trusted the new president of Zimbabwe, maybe I would have that hope. But I fear that the new president might not be as corrupt as Mugabe. That would take real effort. But I still don't think he's going to be that good, unfortunately. I mean, it's sad for the people of Zimbabwe. Okay, I want to talk quickly about this issue of white genocide, which comes up all the time among the alt-right, and I see it all the time on different right-wing news sites. Breitbart talks about this quite a bit. And then there was, I think her name is Lauren Summers or something like that. She went to South Africa.
Lauren Southern,
she visited the farms, and she told the horrific stories of the murders on the farm. Mm-hmm. So to what extent is this a real story? I mean, something obviously is going on, but to what extent is this a real story? To what extent is it blown up? Is there white genocide going on in South Africa? And we can link that up with the general crime rate in South Africa.
Well, to that question, no, I don't think there's a white genocide in South Africa. The attacks that happen on farms are violent, because I think that most of them are racially motivated. I don't think it's necessarily from farm workers on the farms. It might just be people who are desperate. You know, that doesn't justify what they do, but they sort of see that they're poor is caused by white people, and so they act out of anger and that sort of thing. The majority of South Africans are black, and therefore the majority of sort of crime committed is black on black crime.
Yeah.
And people, you know, obviously that won't sell newspapers, so, you know, they don't really want to write about that and that sort of thing. But I definitely don't think there's a white genocide. There's no sort of, you know, we do have high walls and that sort of thing, but I don't think people, you know, barricade themselves in. And there's no, like, stockpiling of arms or that sort of thing. So I think it's blown out of proportion, and we have more serious issues to deal with, sort of like the expropriation thing, than we do to worry about that we're going to, you know, the different race groups are going to start fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at some of the data and the statistics, and the stuff that they report is almost always distorted and wrong and taken out of context. And they report, for example, that 5.2 farmers are killed every, I can't remember what that data is, but that includes black farmers and white farmers and, you know, all races. It has nothing to do with whites. It is true that there is a large proportion that is white, but that's partially because whites are wealthy, and it's usually, they're attacked and their property is stolen. It's also true that the police are probably incompetent and corrupt in South Africa, and therefore they're not protecting people like they should. And I think some of kind of the civil defense of South Africa was disbanded, particularly in the rural areas, which has caused the rise in crime over there. But the fact is that crime in urban South Africa, particularly in Cape Town, but all over South Africa, really in urban centers, is far greater. As you said, black and black crime is far greater than it is in rural South Africa. And it's so high, actually. It's one of the worst countries in the world right now. I mean, it's in terms of murders per 100,000, it's clearly in the top 10 countries in the world. It ranks up there with countries in Central America and other parts of Africa. It really is horrific. And though I always say in countries like that, I always say, you know, the one job of government is to protect us. The one job of government is to police. That's the one job of government, to protect us from murder of all things. Mm-hmm. Stop everything. Shut down every other department. Stop spending any money on anything else the government is doing, and spend it on, you know, on policing. Yeah. And that's how you get rid of the murder rate. But
no,
that's not what they do. And particularly in corrupt governments like the government of South Africa, they spend way too much of the money on other stuff and not enough on the policing side, the policing side of it.
There was an interesting report came out last, I think 2 weeks ago, about the amount of money spent on personal bodyguards for politicians. And,
wow.
You know, that just goes to show you, well, you know, they won't use the police. They'll spend billions of rands on private police.
Talk about corruption. I mean, that their security is more important than the security of the people they're supposed to serve. They are supposed to be our servants, not our masters who walk around with bodyguards, but our servants who provide security for all of us. It's a complete inversion. It's a complete inversion of the situation. Okay, great. Let's one more South African story that I think will cover it, and that is the water crisis in Cape Town. So tell us a little bit about how Cape Town, by the way, for those of you who've never been, probably one of the most beautiful cities in the world. It has Table Mountain right above it. It has this beautiful bay. It has fantastic beaches on a number of different sides. If you go south of Cape Town, you can get to the point where the Indian Ocean meets the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, the whole area is spectacular, and Cape Town in particular is a gorgeous, gorgeous city. Tell us a little bit about, how this city has come to a situation where it has no water.
So we can tie this back to the property rights thing because, it's mismanagement of water resources, and it's only come about, I think end of last year, it came about that, okay, well, Cape Town's going to run out of water, but no one owns the water, so who's going to take responsibility for it?
Yeah.
But then the local government, the Democratic Alliance, they're the second biggest party in the country, and they run the Western Cape. They won that a few years ago, and they're that administrator there. So they started implementing water-saving measures and installing meters in people's houses to make sure that they, use the allotted amount.
Yeah.
And, so a few fascist measures, but, we won't stray that far. But I think it was a case of there is a drought. I'll say that much. There is a natural element of it. It hasn't been the case that people, necessarily just wasted water.
Sure.
But I think that the fact that no one owned any water resources meant that no actions could be taken, nothing could be implemented. And now they managed to delay day zero, which was, the day that Cape Town's taps had run dry. That was supposed to be I think the end of April, but now it's been sort of postponed indefinitely. So you also wonder how dire it really was, whether that was just the local government sort of trying to scare people. But for now they're doing okay. I haven't been to Cape Town for a few months, but I know that when you go, you can only use certain, amounts of liters of water per day. And you have to take a 2-minute shower. And I mean, for a huge tourist city such as Cape Town, it's very bad for the economy and for jobs and growth and that sort of thing. So I think they're managing the situation. I don't see a big resolution necessarily unless they start desalinization, such as they did in Israel. And we've touched on that as well. But a lot of I think a lot of people in South Africa, especially academics, politicians, and students are pro-Palestinian, so they sort of told us don't follow the Israeli model because
Heard that Israel sent some delegations down with some offers of technology, desalination, other things, and nobody would even meet them because the politics there are so left-wing, so anti-Israeli, so pro-Palestinian that they wouldn't even take a meeting. And the Israelis have tried several times to offer technological solutions to the problem of South Africa. I mean, here's Israel, who goes through droughts all the time, and today has no water problem. They have, they could teach California a thing or two because they've used technology to eliminate nature as a variable in a sense, and to make sure that there's always enough water. And but Cape Town is gonna be I think the first modern city to actually see water actually disappear from the taps. A real tragedy. And again, an issue of property rights. It's the same issue with the land confiscation. The same reason I think there's poverty in South Africa. It's a lack of property rights. It's a lack of capitalism. It's the fact that under apartheid we had statism, and since the ANC has been in power, we've had the same kind of statism with the socialism being worse. It's just tragic. Such a rich country that South Africa is. There's absolutely no reason for the amount of poverty that exists there.
Good. Yeah, I think South Africans are used to sort of state control and state intervention. So when you offer them an alternative such as objectivism, they sort of stop and take a breath, and they're surprised that there might be an alternative. So in a way, it's good because you shock the system.
More. Absolutely, we need to expose them to more free market ideas and ideally to objectivism. And let me just say, because I was in South Africa under apartheid, that I thought it was awful. I mean, apartheid was disgusting. It was ugly. It was just horrible. I'm glad that's gone. And I've also on the show in the past praised Nelson Mandela, not as an economist and not as a purveyor of economic freedom, but for transitioning South Africa to democracy without violence, which I would have expected. I would expect the place to explode. And apartheid was so ugly. The way the whites behaved under apartheid was so disgusting that you would have expected a violent response to that. Sure. And I think Mandela gets a lot of credit for having a peaceful transition. So that's the one sense in which, I think in spite of the bad that's happening in South Africa today, I would take it over apartheid any day.
I think the ANC, they could actually tell a much better story about what they've achieved, with more freedom in the country, but they wouldn't, they wouldn't credit freedom with the gains that we've made. It would be more a case, they've given it to people instead of people doing it for themselves.
Well, that's right, because if they attributed it to freedom, people would say, we want more. If it works so well, how come we don't have more? All right, Christo, thanks a lot. Really appreciate your time. It's 2:30 in the morning in Johannesburg, so go get some sleep. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back, and I'll be talking about Ben Shapiro.
At AynRand.org, find out what the Ayn Rand Institute is doing to bring honesty and reason to the way we all deal with each other, the way countries should act toward each other. And if you're curious, at AynRand.org, you can learn about objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy, which says your life belongs to you, and it's your right to live it for your own sake. Philosophy? Who needs it? You do. Find out more about the Ayn Rand Institute at AynRand.org. That's AynRand.org.
All right, everybody, we're back. And what I want to do now is talk a little bit about Ben Shapiro's latest response to me. So I don't know if you know, but we've been going back and forth, Ben Shapiro and I. He made a comment on Dave Rubin's show that Ayn Rand's ethics, or Ayn Rand's the way she deals with relationship among people, is garbage. I then did a video critiquing what he said about Ayn Rand's ethics. And he has now put out a very short statement, kind of commenting, not really commenting on what I said, but taking the conversation a little bit further. I thought I'd comment on this all with the great anticipation that one day we'll have a sit down to talk about this. So what I want to do is I'm going to share the screen here so that you can see the video, and we're going to play the video. I will probably stop it at the relevant places and comment as we go through. But here was Ben Shapiro basically responding to a listener question.
Your subscriber, ask your questions now. Michelle says, hi, Ben. I have long been a champion of laissez-faire economics, individualism, and the logic espoused by Ayn Rand. The atheism and rapey love scenes in her work, not so much. Objectivists balk at me when I say logic and Christianity are not mutually exclusive, that Atlas Shrugged is their Bible and Ayn Rand their deity. Am I wrong? If not, is there a way I can better frame this argument? No, I mean, I think that you're not wrong. This is a debate that I'm supposed to have.
Well, just first, of course she's wrong. Objectivism and Christianity do not meet, do not fit, are not compatible. Logic, reason, and faith are not compatible. But he brushes over this point. It's interesting. He skips over this point and goes right into the issue that he always seems to want to talk about Ayn Rand, which is the ethics. The ethics really bother him. And this is what I'm hoping one day we'll have a chance to actually sit down and talk about. But as I said, her question is, is Christianity compatible with objectivism? And it's not. And he's not clear what he's exactly saying. He's saying she's right, which means it is. But I don't think he thinks that, because he rejects the objectivist ethics and adopts kind of a Judeo-Christian ethics. I don't think he's really answering the question she is asking. He is going off on his thing, but here we go.
I'm supposed to have, I believe, with Yaron Brook at some point. I watched his video responding to me on objectivism. And what it seems to me is that what objectivists tend to do is they redefine virtue in objectivist terms. So
that's right. We redefine virtue in objectivist terms, and that's exactly what we do. Ayn Rand was not a conventional philosopher, conventional thinker, who just accepted the ethical code that existed in the culture around her. She rediscovered, if you will, or she discovered a new moral code. She discovered a new code of virtues and values. So yes, we are, objectivism is redefining what virtue means. What virtue means, we're redefining. We're not accepting the conventional interpretation of virtue.
Virtue in objectivist terms. So traditional virtue has suggested that, for example, altruism is a virtue, right? Ayn Rand says altruism in personal relationships is a sin. It's not a virtue.
That's right. Ayn Rand rejects altruism, not just in personal relationship, in every aspect of life.
She says that altruism is a mistake because selfishness is a virtue as it is in the marketplace. Because in the marketplace, you have a creative impulse to create that leads you to transform the world. And then you want to take that creative impulse and you want to trade that for more capacity to fulfill that creative impulse. And that's how trade happens. This is how the world is better. I totally agree with this.
So this is the Adam Smith argument, right? Self-interest is good in the marketplace. In the marketplace, the baker bakes his bread for his own family, for himself to build, to make, to produce. And because of trade and because everybody's motivated by the self-interest, that enhances society and it grows the pie and everybody is better off. And that's kind of the society is better off because of the self-interest as applied to economic productive activity of the individual. And that's a good thing. So Shapiro here is channeling kind of 240 years of arguments that the pro-capitalists have made from Adam Smith until Ben Shapiro, with lots of people in between, all making the same moral argument. Self-interest is not good in interpersonal relationship. It's not a virtue. It's not something to be admired really in anything. But it turns out that in economics, in the marketplace, there's a positive result. So it's good in the marketplace. So it's evil in other things. It's good in the marketplace. So we'll take it. And capitalism is good, even though the driving force of capitalism, which is self-interest, is tainted. Not a good defense of capitalism.
Economic level. On a personal level, I've always said that one of the funny things about Ayn Rand's work is there are never any children in Ayn Rand's work.
So one of the fun parts of our discussion when I get to sit down with Ben is to point out that I do have children, that this is not an objectivist principle not to have children, because a lot of people seem to make a big deal out of this. This is something really, really important, that there are no children in Fountainhead and there are no children in Atlas Shrugged, even though there are a few children in Atlas Shrugged, as if this is a major flaw in Ayn Rand's philosophy, which is really strange, as if children are what define what should define our approach to life, what should define our approach to ethics and morality. If you don't deal with the issue of children, you don't deal with morality. Just untrue.
Personal level. I've always said that one of the funny things about Ayn Rand's work is there are never any children in Ayn Rand's work. So Yarnbrook would respond to my suggestion that if I were to operate out of selfishness, I would abandon my children, by saying, well, no, that would just be you operating out of like your temporary selfishness.
So let me correct him so he's better prepared for the debate, for the discussion. There is no such thing as temporary selfishness, short-term selfishness, momentary selfishness. None of that exists. All there is the idea of selfishness. All there is the idea of self-interest. And if you're interested in a fuller discussion of this, Greg Stolomieri and I really talked about this. When was it? A week ago, I think. Yeah, it was a week ago. And you can find it online. No, it was 2 weeks ago. Sorry, it was 2 weeks ago. I interviewed Greg, and we talked exactly on this. Greg is a philosopher, and we talked exactly on this idea of selfishness. And the point is, there is no such thing as short-term and long-term self-interest. And you have to balance the short-term self-interest versus the long-term self-interest. Or we as objectivists are against short-term self-interest, we're for long-term self-interest. No, we're for self-interest, which is objectively defined, right? And what is good for you is good for you. Doing things at the short term that are bad for you long term are bad. Those things are bad for you. There is no you separate from the long term. There is no interest that is short term. There is no interest that relates to tomorrow, but where you don't care about the consequences a week, 2 weeks, a month from now. So this idea, again, that people keep returning to, that there's such a thing as short-term self-interest, a long-term self-interest, and you're kind of playing off one off the other, just wrong.
So Yarnbrook would respond to my suggestion that if I were to operate out of selfishness, I would abandon my children, by saying, well, no, that would just be you operating out of like your temporary selfishness. But if you're operating out of your long-term selfishness, you would realize that it is worthwhile to do this. Except for the fact that what objectivism does in the moral sphere with regard to personal relationships is it removes my ability to judge whether a behavior is good or bad. I can't actually judge whether somebody else's behavior is good or bad, because selfishness is by nature a subjective phenomenon.
Now, notice what he's doing here. This is interesting. He's saying that what's important to him here is whether he can judge other people, whether he can judge other people as moral or not. Now, that's kind of strange. Why is that important? Why is that crucial? Why is that? I mean, I do think you can judge other people. I think it's hard to judge other people's morality, but I do think you can judge other people. But why is that the essence? It has to be the essence if you're an altruist, because altruists are concerned with other people. They're not concerned about themselves. Their primary concern is looking out into the world and saying goodbye, bad guy, needy, not needy, judging everybody. Now, I don't think it's that easy to do even within his context, but what bothers him is objectivism doesn't allow him to do that, because objectivism doesn't provide him with commandments that if you violate commandments, independent of any context, I can say he's a bad guy, he's a good guy. I can categorize everybody based on how many commandments they violated. That to me, in and of itself, is a strange way to approach morality. It's a very second-handed way. It's a very social metaphysics way. It says that the primary purpose of morality is to judge other people. No, the primary purpose of morality is to guide your life, is to give you guidance on how to live successfully, how to flourish, how to be a good person, how to be successful in life, in living. And judging other people is a factor in that. It's an important factor in that. It's one of the virtues is justice, which means judging other people. But it's still a secondary. It's only for the purpose of living your own life better. But that whole context, that whole view of morality, that morality is about helping you guide your life, improve your life, make your life better. It gives you the principles, and principle is an important word here because we'll get to that in a second. Gives you the principles by which to live a successful life. That context just eludes Ben and most of Ayn Rand's critics completely.
Buddhism does in the moral sphere with regard to personal relationships is it removes my ability to judge whether a behavior is good or bad. I can't actually judge whether somebody else's behavior is good or bad because selfishness is by nature a subjective phenomenon.
Now let's talk about this. Selfishness is by nature a subjective phenomenon. No. Selfishness is not a subjective phenomenon. It is an individual phenomenon. It is something that in a sense only I can fully define for myself. But the principles, and this is where it's so crucial, and this is where, as you'll see in the rest of this, he misses, the principles are objectively defined. The idea of the virtue of rationality, the value of reason, the virtue of honesty, the virtue, those are principles that guide our lives. The virtue of integrity, which we'll get to in a minute. Those are principles that guide our life. And if you understand objective morality, when you violate a principle like that, it is self-destructive. It hurts you in the present and the future. There is no way to live a good life by violating the principles of morality. And those are objective. Now, how they get applied in any particular circumstances, I wouldn't call subjective. Because
so
that
I can
means
judge somebody if they're taking away from somebody.
Because if it's done rationally, it's done on the basis of reality. It's done on the basis of objective fact. But it's individual, so it's difficult to judge other people's actions because it's hard to tell how rational they have truly been. Judging other people is very, very, very difficult according to objectivism, because whether something is moral or not, to a large extent, depends on whether it was rational or not. And that depends on partially the context of knowledge and the thinking on the part of the actor. And we're not always privy to that. So, yes, it doesn't give you the simplicity of religion. Right? So listen to the rest of this.
Right.
There we go.
Is by nature a subjective phenomenon. So I can judge somebody if they're taking away from somebody else. Right. If they're a leech or a mooch.
He's conflating here subjectivism he's conflating the idea of being objective with the idea of an external party judging, external party looking at it and being able to judge. This, again, is very common among religionists. Objectivity is about its correlation with reality, not its correlation with somebody else's understanding. Something is objective not because I know what you're doing, but whether you are in concordance with reality, with the facts, with reason. So an epistemological point, if you will.
If they're a leech or a mooch, a moocher under the Ayn Rand terminology, I can do any of that. But what I cannot do in the personal sphere is blame a husband for leaving his wife and his children.
Now, that's right. Because sometimes it's good for everybody if a husband leaves his wife and his children. If, you know, I'm pro-divorce. If you can't stand each other and you're fighting all the time and the children are suffering, then you should get a divorce. It's better for everybody. But the idea that the standard should be, can Ben Shapiro tell if this particular divorce was rational or not? And if he can't, therefore it's an act of subjectivity and outside the realm of morality is ridiculous. Some divorces are moral. Some divorces are immoral. Some people get married for stupid reasons. Some people get divorced for stupid reasons. Some people are rational. Some people are irrational. Some people are moral. Some people are immoral. But the standard for morality is not an outside observer's ability to tell or not to tell.
Personal sphere is blame a husband for leaving his wife and his children. Because if he made the personal calculation that his happiness would be maximized by leaving his wife and his children, then who am I to judge that? And my answer to that is I can judge that any time. If he just did something wrong, that is a wrong.
Why did he do something wrong, Ben? By what definition? Where does it? What in reality did something wrong? Now, it's true that if he truly abandoned his wife and his children, then he did something wrong, even by objective standard, because he violated the principle of integrity. He committed to something. He has obligations, and he's walking away from those obligations to the extent that he is not paying alimony or that he's not fulfilling certain obligations that he is legally bound by. Then, you know, he's violating his integrity. If he just walked out, because to use Ben's example from a previous video, because he saw a hot woman at the bar, then he's being a whim worshiper, and he's being short term, and he's being an emotionalist. And absolutely, I can judge all those things in objectivism. I can't judge him actually leaving his wife, but if I know the reasons he left his wife, if I know what transpired, if I know the process, then of course I can judge him from the outside. Of course you can make an objective judgment about it. So there is objective truth. There is a husband leaving his wife where it's moral, and there is a husband leaving his wife where it's immoral. It depends. Now, for Ben, it's always immoral because he's an intrinsicist. It says somewhere, thou shalt not leave your wife, and that's it. Why? Because it says in the book.
He made the personal calculation that his happiness would be maximized by leaving his wife and his children. Then who am I to judge that?
Notice also the way he thinks about happiness and the way he thinks about selfishness. It's a calculus. It's constantly adding up things. So there's also a lack here of understanding of what happiness really means. Of happiness being this state of consciousness, this consistent state of consciousness, this state of consciousness that does not accept contradictions, that does not accept violations of the moral code, that does not accept lack of integrity, for example. So it's not that, okay, how many orgasms did I get in this situation? How many orgasms did I get in this situation? I add them up. And I go for the one with the greater orgasms, and that's maximizing happiness. That's not how happiness works, and that's not how the objectivist moral and ethical view works. The whole moral code, the whole ethical view is, here's some principles that if you act based on these principles that have been induced from experience, from reality, from the facts of reality, that lead to human success and human happiness. And if you follow these principles, you will be happy, you know, banning accidents and really bad stuff happening to you, right? You will be happy. It's not at every point in time I add up all the things that I could be doing over there versus all the things I could be doing there, and oh, the algorithm. That is an unprincipled, subjectivist indeed, concrete-bound, perceptual level view of what human happiness is, and an appropriate and a proper approach to human happiness. It's not about the calculus. It's about living by a rational moral code, living rationally in pursuit of your happiness. But that means following certain principles. All right.
And that his happiness would be maximized by leaving his wife and his children, then who am I to judge that? And my answer to that is I can judge that any time because he just did something wrong. That is a wrong that makes the world worse. It makes his family worse off.
So the standard is what makes the world worse, what makes his family worse, what makes what's good for him or not is irrelevant. So this is a traditional utilitarian, altruistic perspective on ethics. And it's not surprising that I don't think he quite gets the objectivist approach. And you'll see that in a second because it's so counter. It's so... It doesn't fit. And you'll see, Ben is smart enough to know that it doesn't quite belong. And see what he says.
And because he made a commitment, and now he violated that commitment. And, you know, so the objectivist would say, well, what does the commitment mean? The commitment, you know, why should he fulfill his commitment? Because in the future, maybe he has an interest in doing so.
You see, he can't make sense of that because he can't make sense of principles. Because he can't accept kind of principles based on reason. The only principles, in quotes, he accepts are commandments or utilitarian precepts.
Future, maybe he has an interest in doing so. The problem is, there's a line, and I'd be interested to discuss this with Yaron, actually.
Well, that's what's interesting, right? He realizes he's not getting something. He's honest enough and I think smart enough to realize something's off here. So he's interested in talking to me about it, which I'm very hopeful about. Not in terms of my ability to convince Ben Shapiro. I'm not going to convince Ben. But just in terms of having an intelligent conversation, because I think we can. I hope we can. And I think it'll be fun. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to do that.
A line in objectivism that seems to fall quickly into subjectivism when it comes to your personal attitude toward those that you care for and your personal activity and moral behavior. Ayn Rand is a perfect...
No, I mean, none of that is true. It doesn't fall into subjectivism. You know, people fall into subjectivism, but the objectivist morality is about being objective. It's about being rational. All right.
Example of this, right? She ditched her husband.
She didn't ditch her husband. She stayed with her husband.
Her lover, who's 30 years younger than she was, ditched his wife.
He didn't ditch his wife. He stayed with his wife. He ditched everybody afterwards, but he didn't.
They got together. Dagny in Atlas Shrugged is hopping from bed to bed.
Dagny is hopping from bed to bed, guys. She sleeps with three men, all giants, all, whoa, right? I mean, amazing, three men, and he's making her out to be a slut, right? I mean, he's shocked by this, and he says, listen to what he says here right at the end. I mean, Dagny sleeps around? Really? Wow. Listen to this.
Younger than she was, ditched his wife. They got together. Dagny in Atlas Shrugged is hopping from bed to bed, and everybody's just sort of okay with it, right? All of her former lovers are totally fine with this. This is a giant misread of how human beings actually operate in the real world. Time for the mailbag. So,
no, Ben, unfortunately, it's not a giant misreading of how human beings behave in the real world. It is incompatible, that is true, with your perspective on morality, your perspective on sex. You know, there are lots of adults out there who are friends with former lovers of their significant other. So, I mean, the idea that we all hate other people who slept with our spouses, I mean, that is bizarre, and that is a sign of dramatically low self-esteem. And Ben, and we've seen this, I've seen this in other stuff that he's read, has a very, very, very bad, I think, view of sex and a very, very bad view of marriage. And what the two entail. I mean, I'm a strong believer that one shouldn't get married unless one has sex before marriage. So you know what you're getting into. That sex is a wonderful thing that should be experienced. It should be experienced more than with one person if the opportunity arises and if you share values with more than one person. I mean, I'm for monogamy, but I don't believe that you have to pick one person and that's it for your whole life. And you know that whenever you start dating at 17 or 18, you should try stuff out. You should, I won't say sleep around, but you should have sex. You should have sex. Somebody's asking if this is being recorded. Yeah, it's being recorded on Facebook, on YouTube, and everywhere else, I think. All right. Let us take a break. And then I want to do the same thing with Robert Reich. But Robert Reich is it's so dull. Reich's is dull. I mean, there's no content in Robert Reich's so-called critique of Ayn Rand. We will get to that. I don't know if you've seen this video, but I'll be showing it here. We'll be back after this message.
The Ayn Rand Archives has more than 1,500 photographs of Ayn Rand, her life, and her work. Become an ARI monthly sustainer today, and you are eligible to receive the Ayn Rand photo series every month. 2017 marks the 60th anniversary of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. 12 years in the writing, it is Ayn Rand's masterwork. Despite being published 6 decades ago, the novel continues to gain recognition and profoundly influence business leaders, thought leaders, and a growing number of political leaders. Its presence in today's culture cannot be denied. The fascination with Atlas Shrugged persists because it grapples with the fundamental questions of human existence and presents radically new answers. Whether you're an adoring fan who wants to add this new addition to your personal library, or someone who wants to read the book for the first time to see what all the fuss is about, pick up your copy of Atlas Shrugged today. An updated cover for the mass market edition of the novel recently hit stores. Check it out. You can order your copy today on Amazon.
All right, so we are back. And we're definitely working towards some kind of sit-down between me and Ben to entertain all of you. I mean, that's after all, the purpose for which we live. But it should be a fun event. And I talked to Dave Rubin, and I expect that it will happen sometime soon. All right, let's talk about Robert Rice. Now, Robert Rice is one of my favorite in quotes, leftist intellectuals. He is well known. He was Bill Clinton's labor secretary. He is a sharp, smart guy. He is a professor at Berkeley, I think at the School of, I can't remember if it's economics or government over at Berkeley. He is a progressive, a leftist. But what I find interesting about Rice is that he knows what the heart of the argument really is. There's a op-ed of his that I think I did a show on, or at least I read from it in one of my shows, where he basically talks about CEO pay. And the whole op-ed, he basically says, you know, CEO is exceptional. And CEO pay is usually correlated with performance. And on and on and on he goes on all the economic reasons why CEOs should be paid much more than anybody else. And he gives good arguments, all the right economic arguments, right? And then he says, and this is why I like him, because he gets to the heart of it. He says, yeah, from an economic perspective, CEOs should get as much as the market will pay, and the market will pay a lot because there are few CEOs who are any good in competition and da 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 da. But morally, it's unacceptable. Morally, it's unthinkable. Morally, it's offensive. And therefore, we should have caps on CEO pay. So he's one of these guys. I'm sure he has the same view on minimum wage, even though he won't admit it. I think he's smart enough to know minimum wage doesn't make any sense, that it's economically destructive, and that it actually hurts the people it's trying to help. But he will argue for it from our perspective. It's a must. We have to do it. That's Robert Rice, right? He is a huge one of the very prolific writer. He has written a lot about income inequality. That's a big issue of his. Like most progressives, like most leftists, that is a big issue. Well, like most leftists, intellectuals, they realize that the enemy really on the right, or what they perceive as the right, is Ayn Rand. And that one of the ways, I think, to destroy the Ayn Rand brand is to affiliate it with the bad actions of the right. Right? And in this case, it is a he's trying to relate Ayn Rand to Donald Trump, which is an obvious leftist technique. They've been trying to do it for months and months and months. And he put out a video called Trump's Brand is Ayn Rand. Now, those of you who've listened to the show know what I think about that. Donald Trump is one of the villains from Ayn Rand's novel. He is a crony, unthinking, unprincipled thug. You know, in Secretary Tillerson's vocabulary, a moron, not an Ayn Rand hero. But the left, I think, in order to destroy Ayn Rand, not so much in order to destroy Trump, you know, everybody knows what Trump is. So I think the attempt here is not to make Trump look bad. The attempt here really is to make Ayn Rand look bad by association. And by the way, one of the reasons I spend so much time, attacking Trump and making clear to all of you that Trump has nothing to do with Ayn Rand is to prevent this kind of garbage, to prevent the destruction of the Ayn Rand brand by affiliating it with the likes of Donald Trump. So let's look at this video quickly. We're going to do this fairly quickly because there's just no meat to this video. But we'll look at parts of this video and I will respond as we go along. Here we go. Here is Robert Reich.
Donald Trump once said he identified with Ayn Rand's character, Howard Rourke.
I don't think he ever quite said that. I think he enjoyed The Fountainhead and liked Howard Rourke. But you'll notice that this is the only reference actually linking Donald Trump and Ayn Rand. There is no argument in this video that Donald Trump has read a nonfiction, that he agrees with her philosophically, that he has studied her ideas, that anybody in Ayn Rand's universe thinks Donald Trump is a good guy. None of that exists. None of that exists.
In The Fountainhead, an architect so upset that a housing project he designed didn't meet specifications, he had it dynamited.
He was upset that it didn't meet specifications. You guys do with that what you will. Now, I haven't shown the video. Oh, my God. All right, I'll show you the video because you got to see Robert. He's quite a character. All right, you see him now? I think so. All right, so here we go.
In Trump's circle were influenced by Rand. Atlas Shrugged was said to be the favorite book of Rex Tillerson, Trump's Secretary of State. Rand also had a major influence on Mike Pompeo, Trump's CIA chief. Trump's first nominee for Secretary of Labor, Andrew Puzder, said he spent much of his free time reading Rand. The Republican leader of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, required his staff to read Rand.
I grew up reading Ayn Rand. It inspired me so much that it's required reading in my office for all my interns and my staff.
Notice that he's so dishonest. He doesn't actually tell us that Paul Ryan repudiated Ayn Rand and declared himself a solid and committed. Whoops, what did I do here? A solid and committed. Catholic. So, but that doesn't make it. It's just you find one quote that Paul Ryan once said that he has everybody read Ayn Rand, and that's it, right? I wish Paul Ryan was a real Ayn Rand accolade, but he's not, and he doesn't claim he is if you'd updated the quotes. But, of course, nobody on the left is going to actually update a quote to give you the full story. They want to leave you with a particular impression. Now, no, Tillerson, Ryan, Pompeo, all these guys, yeah, they read a book. They liked the book. It might have been their favorite book, a novel. All right, what do we do about that? Now, I understand that let me try to share the screen again. For some reason, it's not screen sharing properly. Where did the video go? We're going to try this one more time and see if it'll work. Let's see. All right, hopefully it'll work now.
Founder and former CEO Travis Kalanick has described himself as a Rand follower. Before he was sacked, he applied many of her ideas to Uber's code of values and even used the cover art for Rand's book, The Fountainhead, as his Twitter avatar. So who is...
So note, he chooses one businessman. He uses a businessman who's been obviously, shown to be somewhat of a bad guy. He did found Uber and did change over all of our lives. I will add that. But he's misbehaved. There's no question he's misbehaved. He chooses this one, nobody else, no John Allison, no many, many of the other businessmen, Tillerson, for example, and the other businessmen he showed there who were great businessmen, and there's no evidence were horrible businessmen as, or did horrible things like Travis is supposed to have done. He chooses one example, no other example, and he uses an example everybody's familiar in the negative. So again, notice the plain sheer dishonesty at what he's doing, how he's picking his examples. He only picks the examples that are convenient, that fit his story.
And even used the cover art for Rand's book, The Fountainhead, as his Twitter avatar. So who is Ayn Rand and why does she matter? Ayn Rand, best known for two highly popular novels, still widely read today, The Fountainhead, published in 1943, and Atlas Shrugged in 1957, didn't believe there was a common good. She wrote that selfishness is a virtue, and altruism an evil that destroys nations.
Now, all of that is true, what he just said about Ayn Rand. Now, of course, he is playing to an audience that is outraged. How can you not believe in the common good? Of course we believe in the common good. The common good, we all know what that means. He'll never define it in the video, but we know what that means. And the common good, I mean, that's obvious. What a monster she must have been. And altruism. Everybody's for altruism. So he's playing to an audience. He doesn't really have to explain it. Now he's going to try now to show how ridiculous that notion is. But even in his wording on putting it down, listen to this. Listen to, you know, let me know what you think of this, you know, how he actually describes it.
An altruism, an evil that destroys nations. When Rand offered these ideas, they seemed quaint, if not far-fetched.
Quaint and far-fetched. Wow. Is that what you felt when you read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged or The Virtue of Selfishness? You felt her ideas were quaint and far-fetched? I mean, what a shallow, stupid, you know, just, again, he doesn't want to even take her, in a sense, seriously enough to give an actual critique. He wants to ridicule and belittle. Really? This is intellectual conversation? Nah, not really.
Anyone who lived through the prior half century witnessed our interdependence through depression and war. And after the war, we used our seemingly boundless prosperity to finance all sorts of public goods.
Now, by the way, our interdependency when it came to war, yeah, we kind of came together to fight the bad guys, but wasn't the war really a result of collectivism? Wasn't the war really a result of the common good? Didn't Hitler use the idea of the common good and the public interest in every one of his speeches? Isn't that what rallied the forces of darkness? Just as much as supposedly, according to him, it rallied the forces of good. And wasn't the Great Depression ultimately, he's a good enough economist to know this, a consequence of failed government policies, of the failure of the government to try to regulate and control the free market? Really? And
boundless prosperity to finance all sorts of public goods, schools and universities, a national highway system, and healthcare for the aged and poor. We
healthcare system that is falling apart. Medicare. This is what he's proud of.
Torn Europe. We sought to guarantee the civil rights and voting rights of African Americans. We opened doors of opportunity to women. Of course there was a good. We were living it.
So of course there was a common good. So all of those are consequences of the common good. Really? Really? We gave opportunities to women out of recognition of the common good or out of recognition of their individual rights? We gave blacks the right to vote and did away with discrimination because of a common good or because they are individuals with inalienable rights, the right to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. No, it was the protection and the recognition of individual rights that led to the achievements, the real achievements, not the fake achievements, the real achievements. The prosperity of the 1950s is not some accident. It is a consequence of industry, of business, of wealth creation, of production, of productivity, of individuals making and building and creating. Not the common good. The common good didn't create the great industries of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and the world in which we live in today. It's those self-interested businessmen. Now, there's a sense in which there's the common good, but it's not the sense he means it. It's a sense in which, if you understand what the common is a collection of individuals. And individuals, the good for individuals is to have their rights protected. So in a sense, the common good is to have rights protected. In a sense, the common good is freedom. But not the common good as the common, but the common as a collection of individuals. The common is what is good for every individual and therefore is good for them all, is the protection of individual rights. All right, back to the video.
Of course there was a common good. We were living it. But then, starting...
Note, by the way, that he never defines the common good throughout the video. He never tells us what it actually is, other than all those social programs and taking credit for winning the war, for example, and a bunch of other things that he attributes to being motivated by common good. But he never defines what the common good is because you can't define it.
But then, starting in the late 1970s, Rand's views gained ground. She became the intellectual godmother of modern-day American conservatism.
Don't we wish?
This utter selfishness, this contempt for the public, this win at...
Contempt for the public? Ayn Rand didn't have contempt for the public. She had contempt for certain members of the public who deserve contempt. But notice this utter selfishness. Again, no definition, no attempt to argue, just use utter, and it appears on the screen, right, in big red letters, this utter selfishness, evil. Clever propaganda.
Selfishness, this contempt for the public, this win at any cost.
Win at any cost? Did he read The Fountainhead? Does he not remember the scene in which Howard Roark walks away from doodles of money on the table because the deal is not consistent with his artistic integrity? Artistic integrity? Above money. But no, this is win at any cost. This is money at any cost. This is do whatever you can. This is his view, the culture's view, the world's view of selfishness. Selfishness as exploitative, as zero sum, as doing whatever it takes, exploiting anybody and anything to achieve your goals. That's not Ayn Rand. That's not her selfishness. That has nothing to do with Ayn Rand. That's your fantasy, Robert Reich.
Reality. Is it eroding American life? Without adherence to a set of common...
Let me just say something, because the left keeps doing this. The 1960s and 1970s were unmitigated disaster. Inflation, stagnation, crime rates through the roof, and ever increasing. At the end of the 1970s, America changed. And Ayn Rand had a role in changing America. I have no question in my mind that in spite of Ayn Rand's opposition to Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan would have never become president if not for Ayn Rand, if not for Atlas Shrugged, if not for the resurrection of the term capitalism. Ayn Rand was integral to the changes that happened in the late 70s, but those changes were good. Those changes turned us around. Instead of an economy dying, instead of an economy stagnating, instead of an economy that was uncompetitive, instead of unemployment rates in the double digits, suddenly the economy started growing and growing fast with low price inflation. Standard of livings accelerated and went up. A quality of life today is a gazillion times better than it was in the 1970s. Just open up a Sears catalog. Just the idea that you might open up a Sears catalog, because that's all you had in the 1970s versus the Amazon of today. The Amazon Donald Trump, by the way, hates. The Amazon of today. I mean, we are so much better off today than the 1970s. It is hard to imagine from a material sense. And America started falling apart in the late 1970s. America started declining in the 1970s. What were the 60s and 70s about? That's when the world decline happened. That's when the falling apart happened. And yet, Ronald Reagan and the changes that happened in the 1980s put some bandages over the disaster that mostly the left, but also the right, had created during the 60s and 70s. And yeah, there were only bandages. And yeah, those bandages have been coming off over the last 20 years. But you're blaming the bandages for the coming apart? What you really should be blaming is all those policies you raved about. The health care for the elderly that is bankrupting this country. The social programs that are institutionalizing huge segments of our population into poverty. It is your so-called achievements in the name of the common good that is what is unraveling America today, not deregulation and tax cuts and an emphasis, a renewed emphasis on American entrepreneurship. That's what has kept this country going for as long as it's gone. That's what's held it together for as long as it's held. It, you know, it's truly unraveling because of Obama and Trump, but really?
Without adherence to a set of common notions about right and wrong, we're living in a jungle where only the strongest, cleverest, and most unscrupulous get ahead.
Notice the package deal. Strongest, cleverest, unscrupulous. And notice the examples he's going to give. All bad guys. All bad guys.
And where everyone must be wary in order to survive. This is not a society. It's not even a civilization, because there's no civility at its core. It's a disaster. In other words, we have to understand who Ayn Rand is so we can reject her philosophy and dedicate ourselves to rebuilding the common good.
Now, it would be great if he actually did that, if he actually tried to understand who Ayn Rand was, even in the effort to reject her. That would be huge. That would be huge. I'd have respect. But that's not what he's doing here. That's not what he's doing here. This is pure propaganda. Nothing but propaganda.
The idea of the common good was once widely understood and accepted in America.
As what?
I mean, after all, the U.S. Constitution was designed for we the people seeking to promote the general welfare.
By protecting individual rights.
Not for me, the selfish jerk seeking as much wealth and power as possible.
Again, that's not Ayn Rand.
Yet today, you find growing evidence of its loss. CEOs who gouge their customers, loot their corporations, and defraud investors.
What about CEOs who create great value and improve our standard of living and quality of life and change the world for the better and make and allow people, millions of people all over the world, to have jobs and actually have almost eliminated extreme poverty from the world? How about those CEOs? No, no, no. We're just going to choose one who's a creep. This is the Shekel or whatever his name is, the guy who did the pharmaceuticals, who was a creep. That's who we're going to choose. That is the representative of CEOs, not the ones who actually exist, who actually make our lives dramatically better. No, we're going to find the one example who is truly a crook, and we're going to package him with all of the CEOs. Let's keep going.
Lawyers and accountants who look the other way when corporate clients play fast and loose, who even collude with them to skirt the law.
What about all the corporate accountants who actually help companies make more money, create more jobs, build more products? What about all the accountants that actually often, usually, if a company is committing fraud, let the government know, because the government's not going to catch anybody. It's much more likely the accountants than anybody else. No, he doesn't even give an example here. He just assumes we all know because we loathe those accountants.
Wall Street bankers who defraud customers.
Wall Street bankers, the only example he's giving is Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff, yes. What about all those Wall Street bankers who saw the internet before any of us did and invested in it and created the wonderful products and goods that we have today? What about those evil Wall Street bankers who funded Apple so that Apple could go on to create all the products that Robert Reich is using? What about Google and YouTube that he's using here to promote his propaganda? What about all the wonderful goods and products and dramatically increased standard of living that Wall Street has made possible? But no, all there is to represent Wall Street is Bernie Madoff.
And publicists who choose not to see that a powerful movie mogul they depend on is sexually harassing and abusing young women. Politicians who take donations, really bribes, from wealthy donors and corporations.
He's using the NRA here. I wish he'd use Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, who got millions of dollars from Freddie and Fannie. Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. And who was single-handedly probably more responsible for the financial crisis than any individuals. Why aren't they on this list? Why is it all Republicans? And why is it only the NRA? Now, I'm against all corruption. I think this is absurd that this kind of money, you know, I see too many politicians going into politics poor and coming out rich. But give me a break. Give me a break. Right? What about all the money funneled in from unions? What about all the money funneled in from your favorite causes, Robert Reich? Right? Now, I'm not going to use those. I'm just going to use, this is propaganda after all. I'm only going to use the ones that fit my story.
Laws their patrons want, or shutter the government when they don't get the partisan results they seek. And a president of the United States who repeatedly lies about important issues.
Ayn Rand would be against politicians lying.
Refuses to put his financial holdings into a blind trust.
Ayn Rand would probably be against that as well.
And then personally profits off his office and foments racial and ethnic conflict.
Certainly Ayn Rand would have been opposed to that.
The common good consists of our shared values.
But we don't have any shared values. I don't have any shared values with Robert Reich. I don't have any shared values with a lot of people. What does the common good mean? Which values? What are the values? How do we decide them? Which common? The common that you like or the common that I like? Which group? The common good only leads to one thing, as Ayn Rand beautifully articulated. It leads to gang warfare. It leads to pressure group politics. It leads to exactly the kind of corruption that Reich has been complaining about. That's the consequence of elevating the common good above the interests of the individual, above the rights of the individual.
We owe one another as citizens who are bound together in the same society. A concern for the common good, keeping the common good in mind, is a moral attitude. It recognizes that we're all in it together.
But we're not.
If there is no common good, there is no society.
All right. If there's no common good, there's no society. Notice the book that he's pitching. I've seen he's got a bunch of talks on the common good. If there's no common good, there's no society. Nope. I mean, not by your definition of common good. By your definition of common good, what you get is the corrupt society we have today. By your definition of common good, what you get is World War II. By your definition of common good, we get all the disasters of history. The only appropriate way to use common good is in the context of protecting the individuals that compose the so-called common. There is no other way to do it. All right. Well, that's Robert Reich. Good music. Bum, 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 bum. That is Robert Reich, and not very impressive. Shallow, superficial, propaganda. And when you see somebody like that, you know he's lying because he knows better. He's not that stupid. He's not that ignorant. And it's sad that this is the quality of the criticism. I mean, I'm waiting. I'm looking. I'm hoping to find somebody who can actually debate using facts, using truth, and debate actual positions that Ayn Rand had. Not make them up. Not create them. Not invent them. And not skew reality so badly as to the one guy we caught on Wall Street versus the hundreds who are doing a good job. The one CEO who is mean and corrupt and nasty versus the hundreds or thousands that do a fantastic job. And all in the name of the wrong thing. So I'm looking for a reasonable, rational critic who actually engage in a rational, thoughtful, facts-oriented debate. I have a feeling it's not going to be Robert Reich, although I have challenged him to debate. And hereby I challenge Robert Reich. I challenge you to debate me. Debate me on anything in that video. Debate me on the common good. Debate me on Ayn Rand. Debate me on inequality. Debate me on the virtue of business CEOs and finance. Anything on that video, I would be happy to debate you. So we'll see. We'll see if Robert Reich. I've actually sent a personal message to Reich to try to get him to debate. We'll see if that ever happens. I think it's more likely we'll have a sit down with Ben Shapiro. All right. Thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Three segments. We might break the video up into three and post them as three segments. Let me know what you thought of this. Is it useful to have these videos and me commenting on it, or is it a distraction? Hope you had fun. It looks like there were lots of comments both on Facebook and on YouTube. Lots of people watching. That's always good. And I will... Oh, tomorrow we've got you're on an Amy show. What time, Amy? What time? I think it's at... I don't know. What time is it? It's 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock East Coast time. 2 o'clock East Coast time tomorrow. The Yuan and Amy show. I think I might try to go to the beach after that. You know, I've been to Puerto Rico now, and I haven't been to the beach. I need to go to the beach. So maybe tomorrow after the Yuan and Amy show, we'll do beach. All right. See you all tomorrow. Bye.